Hi, this is Derek Jensen on the Progressive Radio Network with Resistance Radio. My guest today is Jeanette Armstrong, who is frankly one of the most important people in the world to me. She's been so important to my development as a human being and to my work and to my understanding. I think that I would like to start by asking a couple questions. The first one is, can you tell the readers a little bit, or the listeners a little bit about yourself? And then after that, can you tell me more about your most recent, what you're working on recently, and on your recent appointment as Canada Research Chair?
Okay. Just a little bit about my background. I am Okanagan, a seal from British Columbia, southern part of British Columbia in the interior, and one of the interior Salish tribes. So I grew up in my reservation in Penticton, British Columbia, and I worked all of my life toward setting up a cultural recovery kind of program called the Anelkin Center. And I'm currently the executive director of it, and I'll be transitioning out of that role in the next 2 months, and I have accepted a position as Canada Research Chair. So that's a little bit about my geographical background. I am a fluent speaker of my language and a practitioner of not only the current and contemporary practice of Okanagan culture, but have looked at and researched and discussed and tried to implement things that I felt were necessary to be carried forward from the Seal Okanagan culture.
So what is the Canada Research Chair?
Well, the Canada Research Chair, because I have an appointment at University of BC Okanagan as a Indigenous Studies faculty member. So I teach Indigenous Studies, and I have been looking at, I was part instrumental in organizing that degree program at University of British Columbia Okanagan. And one of the reasons that we started organizing around 2002, and it was finally fully implemented as a baccalaureate degree program, and now is moving up into a master's level program and a grad program. So one of the ideas that was really hard to develop was the idea of an Indigenous Studies program rather than a Native Studies or Native American Studies or First Nation Studies from the anthropological view. What we wanted to do was to develop an academic program that looked at the knowledge that Indigenous people hold in various areas, and to develop a degree program where people, instead of coming to study us as Indian people or Native people or in Canada, First Nations people, they're actually studying what does being Indigenous mean and how is it connected to the land and knowledge and is it important? What might it be important for? So that whole process led to the idea for the university to solicit a Canada Research Chair position so that we could develop and complement that program with research that was significant to the idea of being Indigenous and therefore what does indigeneity mean. So that's what my Canada Research Chair appointment. It's a 5-year appointment, and it's funded by Social Sciences Research Council of Canada. They fund the university to hold a chair there, and it gives me the opportunity to hire research assistants and conduct a research program in the idea of Indigenousness and indigeneity from my perspective as a Seal Okanagan Indigenous person.
So from your own perspective, what does indigeneity mean? What does it mean to be Indigenous?
This will be a long conversation.
Yeah.
Well, one of the first parts of the answer that I could say is, if we were to look at the problems going on in the world, for instance, there has been a directive or a move toward figuring out how globalization, for instance, has created some of, or is foundational to some of the destruction because of the competitive nature of corporations and extraction, you know, of resources and mobilization of peoples in terms of jobs and labor, and the way the countries have sort of segmented and parsed off sections of the world to own, right? And to commoditize. So that, in a sense, is the total opposite to the idea of indigenous peoples and long-term residency and the knowledge and the ability to work within the conditions that are appropriate to whichever place they're located. In terms of sustainability and in terms of the kind of social structure that needs to be organized in order to live sustainably in terms of not only the environment but the community itself. So the idea of being indigenous for anything is to having adapted to the conditions that are present over a long period of time, in terms of being able to not only thrive but also to survive different kinds of catastrophic, you know, interventions and changes that might threaten, you know, the existence of the life forms on the land. So those are, in a nutshell, some of the concerns that I have, as you know, I have always been interested in finding ways to mediate and finding ways to speak about and finding ways to, you know, to see if there can be a different paradigm in terms of society's thinking in relation to how people occupy land. So that was at the center of my PhD in the work of developing a dissertation. What I really wanted to look at was how ethics from the seal point of view related to environmental ethics, is what I'm speaking about. Environmental ethics related to from an indigenous perspective. So all of my PhD research was situated in that particular area, and I really wanted to truthfully look at the idea of indigenousness and the idea of a social paradigm which an indigenous people like the Okanagan people, and that's of course the example that I use because it's, you know, the most available to me, and I speak that language and I live that culture. So the research in that area for me was really an extremely important exercise to look at a paradigm that was practiced and perfected, and look at the principles of ethics that were perfected, and also to see how they were encompassed in the social institutions, how they were transmitted, how they were kept in place, and so on, and to develop an idea of how, you know, what the structure of that kind of social paradigm might be, and whether or not it required a long-term association, or can we look at it from the point of view of developing some principles that the contemporary society might, you know, be able to look at and implement in some ways in terms of returning all of the earth, you know, to an indigenous state, because any kind of any other way in my mind of doing things isn't going to work. So I've been looking at the idea that indigeneity, not indigenousness, but indigeneity, doesn't necessarily require ethnicity. It doesn't necessarily require race or cultural aspects that have been developed by an indigenous group. It really relates to some of the principles of how to be in a specific place and the kinds of you could say the kinds of laws or rules or protocols that the human being could practice within those principles and still live in a contemporary context and, you know, not have to go back to the woods of, you know, 1,000 years ago. Mind you, that would be nice too.
So I want to ask you about some of the principles, or what are some of the principles, but before that, mm-hmm. I want to mention something that, and one of the ways I've learned so much from you has not merely been when you've, you know, when I've officially interviewed you, but also in just some of our conversations, there are so many things you've said that have just stuck with me for decades now. And one of them that always stuck with me was you said, you know, we in our community have squabbles just like everybody else does, but mm-hmm. one of the big differences is that I know that my great-grandchildren might marry my next-door neighbor's great-grandchildren, and so we have to find ways to get along.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems also, of course, that applies to the natural world, that you know, if you're planning on living in place for the next 500 years, your land use decisions are going to be different than if you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And so having said that, I mean, A, do you want to comment on that? And or B, what are some of the principles that you're talking about?
Well, that you've exactly stated what, you know, what one of the major underlying principles is in terms of how community is formed and the basis of how that community must interact with each other and therefore conscionably interact with other life forms on the land. So the idea from the seal perspective of that the kind of required interaction is one that doesn't allow for disharmony, that doesn't allow for the kinds of inequalities that currently, you know, are so present everywhere in the world in terms of classism and, you know, the kind of economic disparities that are, you know, not only basic to, you know, this economy. That's one of the basic principles of this system, is that there has to be those disparities. Whereas from an indigenous perspective, that creates a number of different kinds of probabilities which, you know, are being played out today in terms of the over consumption and the over use of resources and the abuse basically of of the life forms around us in order to meet the needs of a human population without any regard to the other life forms that need to be included in that process of decision making. And so one of the underlying principles is that how the community as a human community operates must also take into consideration on an egalitarian level how we interact with the other life forms around us. And so how you interact with those other life forms must ensure, from the analysis that I did in the work that was the part where we were talking about environmental ethics, it's not so much about sustainability for continued production of a specific thing like, say, logging, for instance, but looking at ways in which regeneration of the whole system, so and under a whole systems process, the idea of complete regeneration has to be underpinned by an idea that every life form has as much right to exist as the human life form. And so that idea of the the human being having dominion or the human being having more right or more privilege in terms of the field of ethics is no different than saying one race has more right and more privilege. And so that's a profound principle to think about. How do you enforce that? How do you create that? How do you act responsibly if that were the bottom line, for instance? How would you create a government? How would you create an economy system? How would you create an education system around that? It's, you know, it sounds really simple, but then you start looking at the complexities of how it would change government institutions and how it would change, you know, laws and how it would change all of those things that would require us to first make sure that every life form can regenerate itself. It means the whole of the system needs to be able to, because everything is interdependent in a biodiversity within an environment, any given environment. And so that's a profound, deep, and complex principle. It's not a principle that is, you know, just simply, indigenous knowledge. It's a very deeply scientific set of knowledge that, you know, that would allow that to happen. And yet when I examined the Okanagan peoples and all the Salish and peoples actually in the plateau area, how their communities were organized, it was really an eye-opener for me in terms of looking at how government is really upside down. And, you know, thinking of gerrymanders' argument, for the local against globalization was, that was really a profound, you know, idea. But then how do you implement it, and what are the principles and what are the possibilities around it? And those were kind of the questions that I was asking and some of the questions that I'll be working on in the Canada Research Chair position.
So can you tell me a little bit more about about some of the sustainable forms of governance?
Yeah, I just did a paper, and I'll be doing another paper on it in New Orleans and at the Ethnohistory Conference there. But I just did a paper recently here at Simon Fraser, and it might be online. I'll see if I can send it, but people might, you know, want to look me up and see if they can find that paper. But one of the things that I was looking at was in the 1950s, a researcher by the name of Anastasio was looking at the plateau tribes of British Columbia and Washington State. And the question that he was asking was really an important, I think, question to sort of give me a footing or a grounding in looking at outside of the Okanagan tribe and looking at all the other sister tribes that are Salish, right? One of the questions that he was asking was there a broader culture or were these tribes, somehow interacting, peacefully because there was no war between them and there, you know, there's like 25 Salish and separate tribes in Montana, Idaho, Washington State, and British Columbia. So of those 25 tribes, there were some other surrounding tribes that weren't Salish and that were also part of that large, what I call, peaceful concord. And I looked at that idea that he proposed, that there might be another culture, a larger overarching culture, rather than the specific tribal cultures. There might be a larger overarching intertribal mechanism. And he didn't call it a culture, he was talking about it as a mechanism of governance. And in other words, a mechanism of agreements in which all 25 would have protocols that, or laws, if you want to use them, intertribal laws and mechanisms that allowed for the peaceful negotiation of joint use, for instance, of resources like the salmon or, whatever other large game and berry fields and root digging fields and so on, because it was, you know, like the Kettle River fishery on the Columbia was a huge fishery. And so I, when looking at some of the, you know, records, I was looking at 15 tribes maybe at a time gathered there, getting along peacefully under, you know, one salmon chief leader who just happens to be my great-grandfather. And him laying down the law to all those tribes that were there about, you know, how many they could take, and how the catch every day was to be distributed equally among all those tribes. And that was happening in a number of the other areas that they, you know, they had that kind of regulatory and kind of equalizing regime in place for sharing of that resource rather than excluding others, finding ways to develop mechanisms to cooperate and share in a peaceful process the resources that instead of stockpiling it and, you know, and using, excluding others and using it in a way to have other tribes have to pay larger premiums or larger prices for them, but finding ways to set up those kinds of mechanisms so that they were equally included. So that was really, you know, kind of the basis of the mechanisms, and he outlined a number of those mechanisms. And so my understanding and my research was to look at how the language and how our traditional knowledge is carried and transmitted and how they were organized in relation to those protocols and mechanisms or laws, if you want to call it that. And therefore, what kind of philosophical ideal and ethic was and values was at the bottom of all of that, which everyone relied on, and realized that there was a very strong ethic of non-aggression, of collaboration, and of sharing, and of egalitarianism, but strong mechanisms that would maintain that and that would sustain those rules through institutional and ceremonial processes between the, you know, the political leadership, essentially the chiefs. So a number of social mechanisms that held that in place throughout Salishan territory. So if we were to look at, for instance, how, say, the cells in a body operate, they're interdependent. And if you look at how an ecosystem operates, any ecosystem, there's this mechanism and of interdependency, which means one part could not exist without the cooperation and the you know, the help of the other parts that surround it. And so if we look at community in that way as an interdependency, and we look at what therefore it might mean in terms of governance or a social structure, then it becomes really exciting research, because in a lot of ways the opposite ideas are in place in regard to government and governance, where government and governance is largely exclusionary and largely protectionist in terms of trying to isolate and protect. And I know this sounds really radical, and that's fine, but, you know, but that's what the research is you know, moving toward and uncovering. And I'm really excited about that idea of looking at what I call eco-mimicry, where the human did what our indigenous people did, is to understand how the whole system works and then mimic that in their social institutions and in their ceremonial and governance process and in their education process. So all of those parts are parts that I'm proposing on working on during my Canada Research Chair, which is a 5-year scholarship.
So when you say mimicking, you're not so much talking about figuring out how geckos can climb up glass walls so that you can mimic that to make military robots that are able to climb walls. But instead, you're talking about, because I've seen mimicry used in that way sometimes, but you're more talking about looking at how the world really is and using that model to help sustain communities.
Yeah, to create models, that are, the abstract models for governance, for instance. Governance is simply an idea of the way you do things and the procedures that are in place in order to maintain how those things are continued to be done, right?
Right.
And so that's an abstract idea. So when you look at what currently the idea, for instance, of democracy and how it operates, or the idea of, the capitalism that exists in terms of how international countries in their trade agreements operate, right? Those are all abstract mechanisms that regulate how people do things, the decisions they make and the decisions they can make and the decisions, not to do certain things and to do other things. And so one of the ideas about mimicry, the idea of biomimicry has been out there in terms of looking at, for instance, how a system is better served by a spiral than a straight line in terms of how it strengthens, if you were to strengthen something. And if you look at the biology of, different life forms, that idea of mimicking that in machinery, for instance, a wind tunnel, for instance, can create a much higher velocity if it's run through a spiral rather than a straight line. And so that's an idea of biomimicry. But what I was getting at is more like looking at the ecology of a system, how a system works. And systems, to me, are ways that all life forms interact with one another. So if you think about a system, for instance, out there, whether it's a riparian system or whether it's... we might lose power here in a few minutes because there's a thunderstorm going on. So if I suddenly go offline, that's what's happening. But in any case, of a whole system, for instance, we're thinking, for instance, about a water within a system, and how that water flows through that system provides a number of different kinds of opportunities for all the life forms that exist in that system. Regardless of they're situated next to the water or in the water, there's a utility that flows through in different ways throughout the life forms, or else they wouldn't be life forms, right? So the idea of looking at how a system operates in that kind of adaptive interdependency between, for instance, if you could say in that system of life forms, right, how life forms feed off each other and provide food for each other and act as food for each other, all the way up the food chain, or what's called the food chain. Can you say that in any part of that system, any one of those parts of that system is more important or less important because of size or because of numbers, demographics, or because of location? It doesn't break down into that,
which is a problem I've always had with
mm-hmm.
with the phrase you had problems with too, food chain.
Yeah, and that's the issue. It's not a chain. It's a whole system, and the relationship between things are much more important than the things themselves. So, for instance, how a tree relates, right, to the undergrowth and all the insects and all the small mammals that live in the undergrowth is that idea of that whole system. So that relationship has to be made visible in some way. And so in a whole systems process, the knowledge of what those interactions are, what those relationships are, what they mean to each other, is what I started discovering in the analysis that I was doing on what's sometimes called our legends or our folklore, you know, and we call our chapticks, which means our knowledge to carry a light into the future. So if the characters in those stories represented relationships in the known ecology, because every indigenous person would have complete knowledge of that system that they lived in. They would have to, because they have to survive in that system. And if they depleted something or overused something, they would not survive, right? And so that idea of knowledge of those interrelationships was what I looked at partly in my dissertation, and I was profoundly surprised to find that's indeed what those stories are about. They're not folklore, they're not legends, they're not, as you know, some of the academics have stated in the past, ways to try to make sense of, you know, wilderness or, you know, or the mysteriousness of nature out there. They weren't that. They were actually diagrams of knowledge of those interactions. And so part of my proof in my dissertation was to say, this is what those stories are about. And we need to be able to look and be able to see those connections. We have to, in our minds, to take them out of the abstract and understand what those mean. And you know, the idea of indigeneity is to create that kind of process and to mimic. This is where the idea of eco-mimicry comes in, and to be able to mimic what nature does in those interactions in order to stabilize how, you know, how we have to participate in that interaction of what constitutes the place we live. So we become a healthy part of that interaction rather than isolated from it or aggressive toward it. And so that idea of indigeneity for me is, one of the basic principles that is missing in terms of the knowledge systems in this world. And I think that it's such an exciting way to look at knowledge and an exciting way to tie in what we as human beings have to learn about how to get along with every other living thing, so that we're not placed in this position where every second person, you know, is going to be affected by an environmental disease of some kind, you know, and maybe more than that in the future, maybe every one of us, you know, and the human being in terms of their very health, you know, we're probably not going to survive in this way for, you know, another few thousand years. And that's the reality. And maybe sooner than that, if all the predictions are right about, you know, the global warming and what it's going to do and how, you know, how critical, when it reaches the tipping point, the kind of crisis that human societies will be in, and other life forms, of course, in this world. So I think for myself, the search for finding more appropriate ways to rethink how we as human beings might govern ourselves is the only way to go, because it's in that process that something is really wrong, something is really broken.
So we have about 10 minutes left, a little bit under, and I want to say one thing and then ask you two questions.
Sure.
And the thing I want to say is that, you know, even though we've known each other, we first met, what, decades ago. I mean, it was like 1992 or 1993.
Exactly.
And even though it's been so long and I have grown so much, it's still absolutely extraordinary to me that one of the things I love about talking with you is the word that keeps coming to mind is subtlety. And, you know, you're saying these things, and even though we've known each other for so long, there's a line you threw out today that just hit me really hard, which was the line about how it's not so much a tree as it is the tree's relationships. And immediately that made me think about the Western classification systems of, you know, dividing this is a Port Orford cedar, this is a Western red cedar, this is something, something. And the Western way of classification is generally to talk about what distinguishes one thing from another, as opposed to, like when we talk about a river, the river is here, and then this over here is not the river. And so how you define the river is by defining its edges, as opposed to talking about the river or talking about the tree in terms of its in terms of its relationships to others, as opposed to specifically the shape of a leaf.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an entirely different way to look at the world. Okay, so I'm going to say that, but then I want to go a different direction because there's one thing I really want to hit before we have to end this conversation, which is two questions. The first one is, so you talked about being the director of the Inalkin Center, and can you talk about Inalkin as what that means and what it is? And then also, we've talked about that for years, obviously, about it being a conflict resolution method, among other things. But then one of the questions that one of the points that you made that's very, very important, which is going to try to tie this whole thing together, is you said that that process, the Inalkin process, only really works with two people who are participating fairly, and it doesn't work with someone who wants to steal what you've got. And how, so which leads to the question of, so first, what is Inalkin? And the second is, yes, what do we do? What do we do about the fact that there are sociopaths who are trying to steal everything?
Well, first of all, I'll just talk a little bit about the Inalkin process. The idea of the word Inalkin comes from a governance and dialogue process that is called Inalkin Wih in our language, meaning that we do Inalkin with each other before any kind of decision is made. And so the idea of Inalkin Wih was really quite a complex. I teach a course on Inalkin Wih in the Indigenous Studies program at UBC. And I teach a grad course and I teach an undergrad course in it. And we also use it and utilize it in all of our communities in the decision making that relates to the land or that relates to other peoples, like the cities that surround us, in terms of the decision making that has to be made by our chiefs and leaders. And so we're re-implementing that process, and we're finding that it really is a much better process than basically what is called the democratic process, in which, for instance, majority rules, right? Meaning that majority will always have tyranny over the minority, the tyranny of numbers. And the minority, if they're a minority, will always be the minority and not have necessarily their requirements or met or understood, even. Whereas the Inalkin Wih process that is part of the Sealk Okanagan people's traditional process is to find a way in which we can exclude all the disparate sectors within a community, or the polarized sectors within a community, and put them through a process in which they're required to hear and understand their most opposite view. So you would be, in this process, you'd be required to fully hear and to fully understand your opposition's reasons and views and perspectives. And they're required to understand everything that you have put forward as your reasons and your perspective. And we create a dynamic polarity of four that's represented in one of our four chief stories. That story actually represents that model, and it's one of the stories that I analyzed in the dissertation. And so one of the things that happens is the process asks you to listen, to understand, to ask questions for clarifications, but it doesn't ask you to make any decisions right away. And so that's the first part of the process. And the second step in the process is to find ways in which, if, for instance, if we put a problem between four opposing sides, right, and we said, present everything, you know, from your perspective that you know about that problem and the reasons why you take the position that you take, that's all that they would do in the first round. In the second round, what they would attempt to do is to find a way from their position to include the other's position. So in other words, I would be given the responsibility not only to understand and hear completely why the other side thinks the way that it does and why it's taken the position that it does, but I'm also given in the second round a responsibility to develop and include their position with mine, and they would have to do the same thing for this side. So they would be engaged in trying to come closer and closer to what you all call a consensus building process. And then in the third round, there's four rounds, in the third round they would develop a vision. Each four parts of the society would develop a vision as to what it should look like from each of their perspectives, given the things that they could implement in collaboration with each other, including. So it's an inclusive process rather than an exclude, you know, trying to vote somebody out and somebody loses and somebody wins, but to try to create a win-win situation. So once that third round is done, and the only round that's remaining is what do we need to do to get to that vision? So that's the third, or the fourth and final round is once that vision has been, you know, has been imagined and in real terms, in terms of how they could consensus-wise collaborate, then the final part is, you know, not a question of, oh, we're going to vote you out, or we're going to exclude you, or we can't do what you're asking. The real question is, how can we do this? Because if we do it that way, then everyone can participate, then everyone will be satisfied, and we will have harmony, and we will have peace. We won't have an argument. So that process is an extremely, extremely intelligent process and an extremely peaceful process and an extremely collaborative process, and it works every time. And so that is one of the primary requirements from our, you know, our perspective in terms of how we must conduct ourselves as civilized beings, in terms of understanding and using our knowledge and our creativity and using our, you know, every skill that we have in place to make things work in that way, so that there isn't anybody excluded or left out or discriminated against. And, you know, that it creates a vast difference in terms of not only the harmony, but the solidarity, you know, toward taking an action on anything. solidarity is huge and immense, and it creates community at a much deeper level than anything else and doesn't divide the community. So in terms of looking at the last question, you know, in terms of how, you know, how we should, you know, what should we do? Well, my belief is that we should always learn that process, and, you know, that process could, you know, could be an advantage to the world in terms of how that process works. What we have said, though, is that the four, you know, partners or the two opposite side must willingly agree to sit down and use the process. You know, in other words, engage in the process. They can't come into the process saying, well, you know, I'll let you do all the talking, but you, you know, you got to do it my way. You got to think about it my way. So you can't come in there with an agenda that undermines the ability of the process to create creative, collaborative, and works that are that really are consensus made.
Well, thank you so much, and I would love to do this again. I think that's all we have time for. So this has been Jeanette Armstrong with Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.